Coming up on New York Now, a conversation about the last 100 days of FDR's life with author David Woolner.
He said all that was within me cries out to go back to my home on the Hudson. And I think he was sincere in that. But I also think he was sincere in wanting to finish the war and establish the United Nations.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. In 2017, C-SPAN conducted its third presidential survey, asking historians to rank, at that time, 43 presidents from top to bottom. Hyde Park's Franklin Delano Roosevelt ranked third on the list behind a couple of guys named Washington and Lincoln. It wasn't a surprise. He's almost always found in the top five of any list. Today, we're going to look at a very specific time period of his four terms, the last 100 days. It's a title of a book by David Woolner, and David joins us now in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Matt.
You are also, I should mention, a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor of history at Marist College.
Yes.
So a lot of background in Dutchess County, where, of course, FDR was from.
Right, right.
Before we kind of get into these last 100 days, we should kind of set the scene. So in late 44, FDR had come with his fourth unprecedented win at the polls in November. World War II, as we know it now, looked like it might have been going the Allies' way, at least in Europe. So let's talk a little bit about what FDR was dealing with at the time. I think you mentioned that the end of 44, as they looked into 45, you called it an uncertain year. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the Allies, of course, landed on June 6th, 1944. And after 6 or 7 weeks of really hard fighting in Normandy, they finally broke out. And suddenly, at the end of July and through August, they swept right across northern France. And at the beginning of September, they actually got into Belgium. They liberated Brussels. They liberated Antwerp. And there was widespread expectation that World War II would be over by Christmas. A kind of euphoria set in. But that didn't happen. Of course, the Allied offensive kind of bogged down in mid-September. You may have heard of Operation Market Garden. That didn't go as well as they had hoped. They were not able to continue their advance in a strong way. And then, of course, shortly after the election, you had the unexpected Ardennes offensive that Hitler launched, which resulted in the famous Battle of the Bulge and the terrible Allied losses. The worst casualties in the European theater up to the war at that point, December of 1944. So it was a real setback for the Allies, and Hitler drove back into the Allied line more than 60 miles. So what had seemed like, the war's almost over, suddenly became, my God, we have a lot of hard fighting, and they hadn't really gotten into Germany yet at the end of 44. So I think for the American people and for the American war leadership, it was a difficult time. They realized that a lot of hard fighting lay ahead. And in addition, this is the moment when you start to see the fissures in the alliance. We always think of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. We think of the issue of Poland, for example, which would loom large in the last 100 days. But we shouldn't forget that the British also intervened in Greece in December of 1944, actually went into Greece to put down a kind of communist insurgency. The communist Greek guerrillas were strong allies of the British and the Americans and wanted to play a major role in the government. And there were tensions in Greece, and ultimately fighting broke out. And so from the American perspective, and this is important to keep in mind, In the American press, there were all kinds of questions. What are we fighting for? Are we fighting for British imperialism? Are we fighting for Soviet domination of Poland? How does this square with the Atlantic Charter? So, and a lot of hard fighting ahead. So, uncertain new year.
Yeah. You talk on a lot, obviously, about FDR's health. Going into that 44 election, it was pretty clear to those who were close to him that he had slipped. Yeah. He was failing. I imagine there were at least some people that were brave enough to broach this topic with him.
Yeah, his the issue of his health was real. You know, his secretary, William Hassett, was quite disturbed that Roosevelt in July just didn't seem to have the energy or the interest really in campaigning vigorously and so forth and so on. Also, the decision to run was one that was difficult. I think Roosevelt was ready to retire, there's no question.
From your book, I get that. I don't know if indifference is the right word, but he seemed to be okay if he lost and he'd just be going back to the Hudson River.
Yeah, he said, all that was within me cries out to go back to my home on the Hudson. And I think he was sincere in that. But I also think he was sincere in wanting to finish the war and establish the United Nations. And so he made the decision to run for a fourth term. What's interesting about that is it wasn't as controversial at that time as it was the third term. Hmm. 1940 was much more controversial. That's where he broke the tradition. Mm-hmm. There's no law against running at that point.
Right.
But the tradition was presidents served two terms, as Washington had said.
Sure.
So that was the controversial one. By 44, people sort of accepted that he wanted to finish. And there wasn't really an alternative in place in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So he did run. But yeah, he was exhausted and suffering from congestive heart failure.
Let's talk about the Yalta Conference that happened in February of 1945, where Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt all met. I really was fascinated by the way you described the journey. As FDR left the Virginia coast and goes all the way to the Crimean Peninsula, he's dealing with rough seas. The roads seemed very treacherous in Crimea. It just seems almost unbelievable that his physician, those close to him, would allow him to take such a trip.
Yeah, it's interesting. He was a little concerned about it. On the other hand, you know, a good sea voyage, quote unquote, was something that they thought might restore him and he thought might restore himself. So on the one hand, it's a little bit like his running for election. There was a kind of, well, it might do him some good or it might be too much. He did closet himself away. Anna plays a very important role. His daughter, Anna Roosevelt, protects him on the voyage and protects him really at Yalta from too much stress. He is healthy enough to carry on his duties. I don't think his faculties were in any way affected by his health. We should remember, too, that Churchill is an old man, and Churchill's struggling with various ailments as well. The journey itself is quite extraordinary. And in many ways, the book is almost a travelogue, because so much of the book is taken up by this seven-week voyage, extraordinary voyage, all the way across the Atlantic through, you know, still U-boat-infested waters and through the Straits of Gibraltar, which was quite dangerous.
Sure.
And onto Malta, and then flying all the way to the Crimea, to Saki Airfield, where Crete was still held by the Germans, and they had to bring long-range fighters, and they actually stationed every few miles naval rescue vessels. I mean, it's an amazing, extraordinary operation, logistical operation.
Another thing that's a constant in your book, and this, I guess, you can parallel to the choppy waters of the sea, is what you touched on a little bit earlier, is that there were some days where Roosevelt was on this high, he's reinvigorated, you know, and he's ready to go, and other times that, you know, he absolutely needed some rest.
Yeah, absolutely. He sends a note to Daisy Sukley as he's pulling into Valletta Harbor, the harbor at Malta, and they're only going to be there for 13 hours. And, you know, he basically says an awful day ahead, you know, because he knows that once he gets off ship or once the ship is in harbor, he's not going to leave the ship. Everybody's going to want to see him.
Sure.
And he's going to have to meet all these people and deal with all these issues. And you know, he's really kind of ambivalent about it. He just wishes he could stay quiet.
Mm-hmm. The meeting was to discuss Germany and Europe's kind of post-war reorganization. That was a big part of the agenda. But another thing that you touch on is what you call the Polish quandary.
Yeah.
What's going on in Poland at this point, and what is driving a wedge at times between the three leaders?
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to what we said earlier, this is the moment at which, you know, in a sense, three things happen in December and early January. You have the British intervention in Greece, which was really big news. And you have to understand that when columnists or writers in the New York Times or whatever, Washington Post, are writing about these issues, they're putting Greece and Poland in the same paragraph. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not all Russia. It's this idea that I thought we were fighting for the four freedoms and democracy and so forth. And then there was a discovery, as I mentioned in the book, at the middle of December that the Atlantic Charter had never been signed. And this created this kind of weird speculation for maybe 48 hours, was this still a valid document, and so forth and so on. So there are a number of, as I said, uncertainty of what's going to happen. There were concerns about the Allied divisions and so forth. So, part of the reason to go to Yalta is to try to settle these outstanding issues. And at the beginning of January 1945, the Soviet Union announced that it was going to recognize what we call the Lublin Polish government, a government that the Soviet Union had more or less established in Lublin in Poland. And meanwhile, Britain and the United States are recognizing the exiled government of Poland in London. So you now have two separate Polish governments. Obviously, that's a big problem. And so what Churchill and Roosevelt were hoping to do is solve this question. How are we going to see Poland going forward? It was very difficult. Obviously, the Soviet Union and Stalin's army is now occupying this territory. So Stalin has already, in a sense, won what he wanted to win on the battlefield.
Yeah.
I think Churchill and Roosevelt did the best they could to try to ameliorate the situation for the Poles. But it was very, very difficult.
And he got criticized for that, didn't he? A lot of his critics calling him, saying he was selling out.
Yeah. I think that's an unfair characterization. I think there was, Roosevelt himself told the Polish prime minister, prime minister in exile, we can't go to war for Poland. You need to create, you need to establish good relations with Stalin. You know, there's a recognition of Soviet power. It exists. And we forget that even at this late date, we hadn't defeated Germany yet. And there's no question that we need the Russians to beat the Germans. And there was even a fear of resurgent Germany after the war. So the primary goal here is to not just establish the United Nations, but to make sure that you bring the Soviet Union into the international community, make them part of the Security Council, make them part of the peace process, because as Roosevelt said, we can't let imperfections lead us down the road to a third world war. And so it was a difficult problem.
The relationship between Stalin and FDR seemed to be a bit of a roller coaster at times, where sometimes they're toasting each other and really obviously showing respect mutually, and other times there was clear issues of mistrust.
Yeah, there are, and also with Churchill. I mean, and that would be a trilateral mistrust in the sense that in some respects, and it's also important to remember that Roosevelt is not alone in this. The Soviet Union, for all of its faults, and Stalin, for all of his brutal behavior, was essentially seen during the war by not just Roosevelt, but by the combined chiefs of staff, the joint chiefs of staff, as a continental power that's concerned about security on its borders. We may not like what they were trying to do on their borders, but it's not, it's quite a different thing than trying to move beyond imperialism and the imperial world. So, and what I say in the book is that Roosevelt was trying to move from an old world to a new world. It wasn't so much about East versus West as about old versus new. And in some respects, British imperialism is more complicated and more difficult to deal with. So it's a really trilateral problem that he's dealing with.
You've mentioned this before, but it was clear one of FDR's missions was to get the United Nations going. It was set for April 26, 1945, in San Francisco, where FDR was going to deliver this speech, of course, that he never gave. But I mean, how important was that United Nations, the establishment of that, to Roosevelt?
Well, I closed the book with a quote from FDR's State of the Union address, which is a fascinating speech. It's not a well-known speech, but if you read it, it's almost as if he's warning the American people about what's coming. And he said, in our disillusionment with the last war, we let the differences between us, we didn't have the courage to face up to our responsibilities in an admittedly imperfect world. It's not going to be perfect. But he said, we can't follow that same tragic road again. If we do, we're going to follow the road to a third world war. So I think what Roosevelt was determined to do is he saw the failure of the Treaty of Versailles being linked in part to the fact that that negotiation took place after the war was over. And so he's trying to use the fact of the alliance, the existence of the Grand Alliance between the Russians, the Americans, and the United States, as a means to establish the United Nations before the war is done. Mm-hmm. So we get the institution up and running. You know, it's, as I said, this is not to say I don't think Roosevelt sold out Eastern Europe to Stalin. As I said, that's a very difficult problem to confront. I think what we need to understand is he recognized that Soviet power is a reality. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to try to move the world forward and avoid a third world war, you need the Russians to be involved in the Security Council and in the United Nations for all their imperfections. And so while he was sympathetic to the Poles and other issues, his primary goal at Yalta was to secure the Russian cooperation in the United Nations. And also, we shouldn't forget to secure Soviet participation in the war against Japan. That was vital to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In fact, Admiral Lee, he said it was worth the whole trip to Yalta once they got that agreement locked down. You know, China was failing. We had great hopes for China. The Russian threat to Manchuria would tie down thousands and thousands of Japanese troops on the Asian mainland. We were anticipating having to invade Japan. So we needed the Russians, just like we needed to defeat the Germans. So, you know, that helps explain a lot of what happens in the war if you look at the, the kind of physical reality of what's going on.
So how is the Yalta Conference viewed at home? Of course, FDR gave his kind of famous speech on the floor to the joint session in his wheelchair, which he didn't do very often, which is kind of a sign of how kind of beaten down he was. How was the Yalta Conference viewed back home? Was it a success?
I think it was treated initially as a success. Remember, this is the other thing, is we tend to look at the Yalta Conference as sort of final point of the war. For Roosevelt and for those involved, it was the beginning. It was, you know, it was, they were trying to decide the issues of the final defeat of Germany. They wanted to make sure that the Russians were involved in the United Nations. They wanted to secure Russian support for the war against Japan. And they tried to secure Polish independence through the establishment of free and fair elections and so forth. And we should not forget that it was Stalin who violated those agreements, not the United States or the British. So he came home, and his speech is really about, this is the beginning. You know, again, he says, I understand concerns about Poland and Greece and so forth and so on, but the three allies are still working together. We have the San Francisco Conference coming, and this is the beginning of a new chapter of trying to work together to ameliorate these problems in the future.
So he comes back to the U.S., that speech about a month or so before he actually died. People are clearly seeing that he's... one person described him as dead and dug up. I mean, he looked very, very bad. It was a rough go for him, and people were seeing that firsthand.
I think one of the most extraordinary scenes in the book, not to give too much away, is this really dramatic scene where he is wheeled forward to give the Yalta speech in front of the entire house. It's not just he's in the wheelchair. He's actually wheeled forward down to the well of the house while people are cheering him. And he apologizes for sitting down and says, you know, of course, you'll forgive me for this, having made this 14,000-mile journey. But it's very touching because both Eleanor Roosevelt and Frances Perkins, watching this, had the same thought, and it's recorded in Eleanor's biography and also in Perkins' diaries, that he was finally admitting to the world and to himself that he was what they termed a crippled man. So it's a very powerful moment. By this point, you know, when we get into March and late March, he's trying to recover his health. By the third week of March, he's getting very frustrated with Stalin. He's actually kind of fed up with
kind of
all
pounded his fist, right?
He pounded his fist, meeting a woman named Anna Rosenberg, who was a high-level official in the Department of Defense, getting a message that, you know, Stalin is still stalling on the establishment of this provisional Polish government, which is supposed to establish these free elections. It's not happening, and he pounds his fist and says, Avril Harriman, the ambassador, is right. You can't trust Stalin. So, you know, You can see the frustration is coming, and we don't know what he would have done had he lived, you know, another 6 months or a year with respect to these issues.
So he goes to Warm Springs in Georgia, where he spends the last couple weeks of his life, and that was in an effort to kind of build him back up right before he goes to San Francisco and gives this big speech at the UN.
That's right. You know, what's fascinating about this story the last 100 days is how little time he's actually in the White House. You know, after the election, he immediately goes to Warm Springs to kind of recoup. Then he comes back to Washington. Then he travels up to Hyde Park for Christmas, only the second time in his presidency that he spent Christmas holidays in the Hudson Valley. Then he goes back to Washington to give his State of Union address and take care of all of that. And shortly after that, he's on ship to go to Yalta. He's gone for over six weeks. And when he comes back, he does spend what I call the longest period in the White House, is about 16 days in the middle of March. And then he's off to Warm Springs again, which was typical. He would typically sort of go there around Easter time to enjoy the spring, you know, early spring in Georgia, which is beautiful, and, you know, catch his breath and try to rejuvenate himself. And all of his staff and family are looking and hoping that this is what's going to happen. But of course, he dies.
During this time, you describe many conversations he's had with what is known as the Manhattan Project, the building of the atomic bomb. He held that, of course, very close to his vest, but he knew that was something that was coming and would probably be available if needed that summer.
Yeah, that's another fascinating story. You know, what precipitates the Manhattan Project is a famous letter that Roosevelt gets from Albert Einstein in October of 1939. That letter was actually at the instigation of Leo Szilard, who was a physicist who understood the import of this and needs somebody famous to get Roosevelt's attention. And so the most famous scientist in the world is Albert Einstein, who was not involved in the Manhattan Project. Well, you know, you fast forward 5 years, and Szilard is in Chicago, and he suddenly realized this is going to happen, and he's having terrible second thoughts. What have we done? And he wants to have a meeting with Roosevelt.
Yeah, urgently.
Urgently, to warn him and to say, you know, have you really thought through the ramifications of this? And so he goes back to Einstein. He can't even call or write to him. He has to travel all the way from Chicago to Princeton to meet him in person to say, I want you to write a second letter. Mm-hmm. I want an appointment with the president. So there is a famous second letter that was sent in the middle of March, which Roosevelt does receive. It was delivered, by the way, through Eleanor Roosevelt, because they both realize if you really want to get to Franklin, you go through Eleanor. And Szilard is thrilled because he gets a response from Eleanor Roosevelt saying, yeah, the president's willing to meet with you on the 8th of May. And Szilard's sitting at his desk reading this, and he's about to get up to tell one of his aides how thrilled he is. And of course, the man comes running in and says, the president has just died. Yeah. It's April 12th. So we'll never know. That conversation that he wanted to have about the moral implications of the bomb never took place.
A couple more questions before we have to go. From reading your book, one name is not mentioned very much at all, and that's Harry Truman. From the outside looking in, it seems like, you tell me, how much out of the loop was he
Truman was
to
very
all
much,
that Roosevelt was doing?
Yeah, Truman was very much out of the loop. I think it's a really fascinating story, and we don't have time to get into all the details, but two things I would say. Number one, I make the point in the book that 1940 was really the critical decision. The decision to run for the third term was the most unprecedented, and that's when the war is really starting to really become real. And Roosevelt was very concerned about who's going to be the vice president. I think he was concerned about the future of the New Deal. And so he picks Henry Wallace, who was really one of the champions of the whole New Deal legacy. And he actually says to James Farley and others at that time, you know, a man like me could drop dead at any moment. So I have to think about when it comes to 44, the Democratic Party bosses don't like Wallace. He's considered too left-wing. He also was a former Republican. They just never, and he wasn't a politician. He didn't like politics. And so they basically orchestrate the selection of someone else. That ends up being Truman. Roosevelt doesn't oppose or endorse any of this, but he doesn't get in the way. And so it's pretty clear that he's, you know, he's willing to drop Wallace if that's what they feel they want to do. So Truman comes in, and you know, Truman has not that much experience in foreign policy and so forth. But we should remember that the vice president, you know, that was a place where you sort of sent politicians to go to disappear. It wasn't the office that we think
of today. Like Teddy Roosevelt, right, in 1900. Yeah, that was the idea.
This was, it wasn't, you know, there was no, and it was very unusual for Roosevelt, for example, to give Wallace the considerable war responsibilities he gave him. That was not typical of the vice presidency. So I don't think it's that unusual that Truman wasn't, you know, sort of briefed on everything. I also, you know, we need to remember Roosevelt wasn't there. They physically were never, almost never in the same space, because from the time of his reelection in 44. You know, he's Warm Springs, Hyde Park, then off to Yalta. So there was actually very little time for the two of them to sit down together. I think that is a big part of the story too.
And lastly, we got about a minute left. His death, as viewed across the country, it's a real mourning, right? Because so many people had only known FDR as the president.
Yeah, I think the most profound reaction, of course, is among the American servicemen and women across the world. And so many soldiers said that it was like losing their own father. They couldn't quite grasp it, you know. In fact, I heard personally from Senator Inouye this tremendous story that he told when Roosevelt died. He was serving with the Nisei Regiment in Italy. He was the commander of a platoon of soldiers. And of course, these are soldiers that have been interned in Japanese internment camps. And he got word that the president had died. He was told that he had to tell his men. Many of them didn't speak much English, spoke most Japanese. So he goes and he gathers his men together and he said, "I have to tell you." And he said he was waiting for the reaction to tell you that the president has died. And he said there was dead silence. And then the click, click, click of bayonets going on the end of the rifles. And then one of them said, "The next one's for the old man."
It was quite a story. It's quite a book. The book is called The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and Peace. The author is David Woolner. He's also a senior fellow and resident historian of the Roosevelt Institute and professor of history at Marist College. David, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Matt. It's my pleasure.
And thanks so much for joining us here on New York Now. We'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station. Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Ryan. If you like what you hear, rate and review us right on your mobile device. When you do so, it makes it a little easier for people trying to find us. And thanks so much for listening to the New York Now podcast.